Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Attention Talk Radio, the show centered around paying attention to what is being paid attention to, with your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper.
Welcome, everyone, to this edition of Attention Talk Radio. I'm your host, Attention Coach Jeff Copper, and I'm very excited. We got a great show for you tonight. The topic is the history of ADHD, and with us in our virtual studio is Dr. Russ Ramsey. We're going to jump into the mix here real quick because we've got a lot to cover tonight, and I'm particularly excited about this because I think it's going to be kind of fun. I want to remind everyone out there, particularly our iTunes listeners, most of you are listening to the show off of download. You can access future shows if you go to attentionradio.com. That's not our homepage. It's attentionradio.com, and sign up for our newsletter, and we'll send you a newsletter bi-monthly that will list all of our upcoming shows. And I'm pretty excited. We're actually scheduled out at this point to the middle of May, and we've got some exciting stuff kind of going on. So know that you can do that. Now, regular listeners that go to Attention Talk Radio and listen to us off of our homepage, you can certainly access our schedule, upcoming shows for the next 4 months. But again, if you're not the person who likes to seek that stuff out, go to attentionradio.com and sign up for our newsletter, and we'll have it delivered straight to your inbox. I'd like to acknowledge Chad. Children and adults with attention deficit disorder are advertisers that are on board, and they're going to be with us here for a period of time, so we're real excited about that. And I think we've got some new advertisers that are actually going to be jumping on next week. Okay, so let's see. We've got that aside. Just some upcoming scheduling stuff. Next week we're going to have Ruth Hughes, the interim director of UpChad, that's going to come on. We're going to talk about their membership benefits. And honestly, it was exciting for me today because I called their information line and found out basically there's a librarian that's there that can really help you access all kinds of data that's hard to find on the internet. And I can't if you're interested in good information and some help, you need to tune into that show next week. The following week we're going to have Dr. Russell Barkley on talking about the importance of emotion and understanding and managing ADHD. Wendy Richardson is going to be on the week after that talking about ADHD and addiction, and then Dr. Michael Linden is going to be talking to us for 2 weeks about QEEG and neurofeedback. So with that aside, let's move into tonight's content. Again, with us is Dr. Russ Ramsey. He's the co-director of the University of Pennsylvania Adult ADHD Treatment and Research Program and associate professor of clinical psychology and psychiatry at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Dr. Ramsey received his PhD from Pacific Graduate School of Psychology, also known as Palo Alto University. He completed an internship at CPC Behavioral Health in Red Bank, New Jersey, and his postdoctoral fellowship at the Center of Cognitive Therapy, University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. He's co-authored numerous professional and scientific articles and book chapters and has lectured internationally on various issues related to adult ADHD. He's the author of Cognitive Behavioral Therapy for Adult ADHD, an Integrative Psychosocial and Medical Approach, and the Non-Medication Treatment for ADHD, Evaluating Impact of Daily Functioning and Well-Being. Dr. Ramsey serves as editorial board of the Journal of Attention Disorder and the Journal of Psychotherapy Integration. He also serves as co-chair of the Professional Advisory Board of the Attention Deficit Disorder Association, that's ADDA, and on the Professional Advisory Board of the Buck County, Pennsylvania Chapter of Children and Adults with Attention Deficit Disorder. He's lectured internationally regarding various issues related to ADHD. I also point out that he's going to be with us in the middle of May for a show on non-medication treatment. So with that, Dr. Ramsey, welcome to the show.
Jeff, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I'm actually really excited about tonight because this is a topic that I kind of came up with and did a little bit of research on myself and has found it kind of fascinating. And I guess let's just kind of jump into it. Can you just begin at the beginning? Let's go back to when ADHD was first really recognized.
Right. And you know what? It is interesting because it's a topic. There's so much or perceived controversy about ADHD now, what it is. It's really interesting tracing it back. Now, the person who is pretty much considered the father of ADHD, I mean, we could make the argument as long as there has been a human brain or a population of human brains, there's probably been an incidence of ADHD. But the person who is credited with really bringing it to the attention of the scientific community is Dr. George Still, who in 1902, he presented a paper on a study of 43 children who were suffering from various examples of impulsivity, inattention, high emotionality, or what he called back then passionateness, which is very consistent with what we see in today's diagnostic criteria for ADHD. Now, interesting about the 43 children he studied, 23 of them, the difficulties, the impulsivity, the behavior problems could probably be traced back to some sort of brain injury. But however, what's interesting for ADHD, there were 20, normal IQ, no history of brain damage, who were still having these difficulties. And it was very interesting, and again, Still gets a lot of credit for this, similar findings to what we see now, about a 3-to-1 boy-to-girl ratio in the sample. Even though he focused on the behaviors, he talked about features of inattention. He noted how the behavior seemed to be resistant to consequences or punishment. And he, you know, hypothesized that it seemed to be not really necessarily the result of bad environment, but may have been innate or what we would consider today to be more genetic or temperamental.
Well, that's fascinating because he was actually acknowledging that 100 years ago.
Right, 1902. So, again, it was like one of the first instances. Now, more recently, there was a chapter uncovered by a gentleman named Alexander Crichton in 1798 in which, just based on his observation, it wasn't as scientific a study as Dr. Still's, but Crichton focused on, was very interested in attention, and the whole notion that, you know, will, if you will, free will, it's really driven by what we pay attention to and what we select out, and based on these observations, he hypothesized that some people will have problems with attention, having difficulty purposefully redirecting their attention to what's important, and that this could cause problems with educational pursuits, being able to do things in one's day-to-day life, being able to enact and direct one's will, again, very prescient and can be seen as the maybe the first instance, at least in an extended discussion, of a disorder of attention and also some of the behaviors that would go along with it.
So what I'm hearing you say is back in 1798, that's the first documentation that somebody was actually kind of discussing this that sounds like it's related to ADHD, but actual study was what George Still did in 1902 that actually say, wait a second, we think we have something here.
Right, and sort of in between the two and a connector, give some credit to the he didn't talk about disorders of attention as much, but the American psychologist William James focused a lot on attention and really could be seen as drawing a bridge between Crichton and Still with the focus on how attention and will or, you know, what Russ Barkley today would call self-control, you know, self-management, and the impact that can have on our functioning.
Interesting. So this is – It's fascinating to me that this goes back about 200 years. We have some, I mean, at least the papers that are kind of written about that. The science has come along. And I got to, as we'll, I assume that we're going to kind of uncover, there's been slow progress, although I have to say in the last 20 years, I think it's kind of accelerated in our understanding of what's going on. I tell you what, Dr. Ramsey, let's do this. Let's kind of cut to a commercial break real quick. When we come back, let's kind of pick up on what happened post Dr. George Still. But before we do that, for anybody out there who's got any questions, how can they contact you?
Probably the best way to get in touch with me is through email. And my email, it's a little lengthy, but it's my last name, Ramsay, and you got to get the spelling right, Ramsay, at mail, M-A-I-L, dot med, M-E-D, dot UPenn, with two N's, dot E-D-U.
And for those out there, if you don't have a piece of paper and a pencil, we're going to ask them again so they can write all that stuff down a little bit later in the show. And with that, we'll be right back.
Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio. News, updates, and alerts sent right to your inbox. Sign up now at attentionradio.com.
ADHD, is it real? How is it diagnosed? How do I know if I have it or if my children have it? Do you outgrow it? You have questions and we have answers. We're CHAD, a national organization made up of professionals, parents, educators, and of course, those with ADHD. So if you want real answers to your questions, join CHAD at www.chadd.org or call us at 800-233-4050.
This is your ADHD information station. Attention Talk Radio.
I'm Jeff Copper, host of Attention Talk Radio, here to talk to you about CopyTalk.com, a voice dictation service. This is not just some voice dictation software. It's a real dictation service by people who type whatever you want. When I need to document something, all I do is hit speed dial on my cell or work phone and start speaking. The folks at CopyTalk will type it up and email it back to me that day. The best part is I can dictate as many 4-minute messages as I want, all for one flat monthly fee. Go to copytalk.com/ATR, enter Jeff Copper as the referrer's name, and sign up for the free trial account today. If you tell them I sent you, then you'll get $20 off the monthly subscription for as long as you keep the service.
Okay, let's be honest here. How many times have you forgotten the wet laundry in the washer and it started smelling a little funky, so you had to wash it again, maybe even twice, in the same week? Well, you may be an AD diva just like me. I'm Linda Rogley, and I founded the AD Diva Network for women with ADD-ish tendencies, especially those of us 40 and better. The AD Diva Network is a great place for support, connection, and a touch of whimsy. You can join us at addiva.net. That's addiva.net.
Be a part of the show. Dial 646-652-4409. You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Attention Talk Radio. With us tonight is Dr. Russ Ramsey. We're talking about the history of ADHD. Before the break, we talked about the original papers, first documented papers talking around that stuff was back in 1798, and then Sir George Still actually doing some studies in 1902. Moving forward, Dr. Ramsey, how did the history unfold from there?
Well, after Still's paper, it sort of generated some interest in looking at childhood behavior. Another watershed moment, it's sort of two things happened around the same time. There was an encephalitis epidemic around 1917 or 18,
mm-hmm.
and it started the field of behavioral neurology. And also the other thing that contributed to this field was the soldiers from World War I who may have suffered head injuries. And the field took a look at some of the behavior changes associated with head injuries. And very often, some of those changes would be increased impulsivity, distractibility, irritability, destructive, unruly behavior that was out of character to pre-injury functioning. Now, obviously, when there is a head injury, encephalitis, it could be tied into brain damage. But what started happening when these behaviors were seen in children, they started drawing the connection, well, maybe this is evidence of some sort of brain damage. And so that's where the term minimal brain damage or brain damage syndrome started to become associated with what we now call ADHD. Later on, more people started criticizing that connection to say, just because you see these behaviors, you can't automatically assume that there's brain damage. Because later on, when there wasn't some overt sign of brain damage, the assumption was, well, maybe there was some sort of mild injury at birth, some sort of mild injury, so it was minimal brain damage, MBD. But then later on, researchers and clinicians were saying, well, there may not be, if there's no evidence of brain damage and you can't see any, you can't really say this behavior is caused by brain damage. But there was then the assumption, maybe there's some sort of dysfunction in the processes of the brain that result in this disinhibition, hyperactivity, and attention. So then MBD became minimal brain dysfunction.
Mm-hmm.
So again, we're seeing this by, so this time is probably the 50s or 60s. And after that, now once we get into the 70s, we get the work by Paul Wender, and into the 80s, Virginia Douglas. Wender came up with what are now called the Wender-Utah criteria, but taking a look at the impulsivity, the hyperactivity, and starting not really worried about is there evidence of brain damage, looking at the syndrome itself and starting to look at the similar symptoms and behaviors that would characterize these children. And in 1968, in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association, the Diagnosis Bible, if you will, the second edition, now we see the hyperkinetic reaction of childhood or adolescence. And pretty much, it's pretty much one sentence describing children characterized by overactivity, restlessness, distractibility. It does have the cognitive piece. But it was generally thought of that by the end of adolescence, children invariably grew out of it. So now we have the first diagnostic criteria to characterize these behavior problems in children. Later on in the 80s, Virginia Douglas from Canada, she started focusing more on the attention problems, that we'd see the hyperactive behaviors, but her theory was, well, maybe this is because the children are so inattentive, their behavior problems come from the rapidly shifting attention, not being able to hold attention on one item. So the third edition of the DSM, that's where we have attention deficit disorder, ADD, either with hyperactivity or without hyperactivity.
Let me kind of pause for a second. It was interesting because back in 1902, George Still was talking about it was an innately hereditary, and then it took a term to some type of brain dysfunction or kind of brain damage as a result of something. Why do you think that took place?
Well, actually, you got to remember, more than half of Still's sample, there was brain damage.
Okay.
And I think part of it was we just didn't have the same imaging technology that we would have today to either diagnose the brain damage, or even right now, if we're looking at the processes in the brain, hey, the neuroimaging still is not perfect. You could have somebody who has, you know, the neuroimaging might show a profile of a brain, like a PET scan or whatnot, that you might say, this looks like there's underactivity in the areas we'd expect from ADHD, but they don't manifest the symptoms. Or conversely, somebody who, hey, there's nothing showing up here, but they might have the behavioral syndrome of ADHD. So even today, it's not perfect. But again, I think there were limitations and just the inferences people were making along the way, especially with that that period of behavioral neurology around the 1920s.
Well, it's interesting because I kind of feel like they were kind of lost looking at it was a problem at birth or something. And then in the 80s, what Virginia was doing, I feel like there's a shift that's kind of taking place to like, no, it's not necessarily that. We're getting back on track to actually kind of find out what's going on.
Right.
And particularly with the DSM adding it into the criteria and the redefining from away from a deficit or moral control or minimum brain dysfunction into actually ADD or ADHD. Seems to like kind of we're starting to get on track to kind of bring us to where we are today.
Right. And even with the evolution of the DSM, around DSM-3 and then the revision 3R, the goal of the DSM was to have more research-based criteria. So that's where, you know, the work of Wender, Douglas, and many others were starting to take a look at, all right, what are the common symptoms, the features that we see in these children and, as we know now, adults, that, you know, describe the syndrome so that we can reliably diagnose it, and now maybe we can start working backwards to understand, you know, what are the potential causes of these difficulties rather than automatically assuming, well, this looks similar to brain damage, so it must be brain damage.
Absolutely. So it's we're getting the bedrock back in the 80s, kind of pulling this stuff together, kind of form what we have right now. Back in those times, were they distinguishing the different types of ADD, or was it all kind of just lumped together?
I think there were discussions, but for the diagnostic criteria, like in the DSM-3, it was attention deficit disorder, ADD, either with or without hyperactivity. So there's some acknowledgement of subtypes. Then the next version, DSM-3R, it turns into, it was ADHD and a single list of 14 criteria. So it was lumped together.
Mm-hmm.
Now in the DSM-4, we're back to the subtypes of the primarily inattentive type, primarily hyperactive type, or the combined subtype. And with the DSM-5, so far it's still being worked out, but it looks like they'll keep the subtypes. But they're looking at, with the inattention, at least in the proposals, nothing's definite yet, there's like a circumscribed inattentive type where there's prominent features of inattention and no more than one or two of hyperactivity. So it's almost like a purely inattentive type.
Sure. And so when was the DSM-4 actually kind of put in place?
DSM-4 was 1994, and they had the text revision, just updating some things in 2000.
And they're right now they're redoing it for the DSM-5.
They're revising it based on the subsequent research that's been done, and they have work groups right now, and they released some proposed drafts, and we're gathering feedback on it, and now I think they're integrating that feedback.
So it's been 20 years since it's been updated at this point.
I'd say with the text revision, we're looking more at, because I think that was 2000, so it's like 11 going on 12 years now.
Excellent. I tell you what, I want to run off to another commercial break, but when we get back, I want to touch base on just a little bit of the history of when stimulants were introduced and some of those types of treatment, and then kind of round out where we are, and if we can, we'll just talk about what your vision is for the future. So, again, before we go to break, can you share your email address again?
Sure. It's my last name, Ramsay, R-A-M-S-A-Y, at mail, M-A-I-L, dot med, M-E-D, .upenn.edu.
And with that, we'll be right back.
You're listening to Attention Talk Radio. We'll return in a moment. Your life, your world, your choice. This is Attention Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Dr. Ari Tuckman, author of More Attention, Less Deficit: Success Strategies for Adults with ADHD. This is the only book actually written for adults with ADHD. Each chapter is divided into short articles, so you can read only the stuff you want in the order you want. I take lessons from the research and make them totally useful in your daily life. You can get a free PDF of the first chapter at adultadhdbook.com. Check it out.
Could hiring an attention coach really help you move forward? Does a child get wet when they dive into a swimming pool? You can get started moving forward today. Just call Dig Coaching Practice at 813-837-8084 and schedule a free consultation. Tell us you heard about us on Attention Talk Radio and get 50% off your discovery session. For more information, visit digcoaching.com. Don't delay, do it today.
And now, back to Attention Talk Radio.
Welcome back. We have Dr. Russ Ramsay talking about the history of ADHD. Jumping back into things, time flies on the show. We got about 7 minutes to go. Dr. Ramsay, can you review a little bit of the history of at least the stimulant side, when they were introduced and when, what type of stimulants were used, and bring us up to today?
Right. So before, like after Still and in the early days of like the minimal brain damage, the main focus was on, you know, modifying the classrooms. It was a fair number of people. It was blame the parents. This is bad parenting, which, you know, over time sort of weaned away, even though we hear remnants of it here and again. The stimulants, like it's almost like most great discoveries happened by accident. Charles Bradley, a pediatrician, during that time there was like a spinal tap X-ray procedure that would leave the children with bad headaches. So he thought, well, if I prescribe a stimulant, a benzedrine specifically, he hypothesized, well, that might create some relief from the headaches because it should target a certain area,
mm-hmm.
And found it really didn't help with the headaches. But then he got feedback from the teachers of the children that he gave the stimulants to that their behavior was improving. In fact,
wow.
Some of the teachers dubbed them the arithmetic pills, because the students were able to sit still, get through their lessons, and actually process the information better, which we now understand the effects of the stimulants promoting dopamine release in the prefrontal cortex. But back then, it was just, hey, this seems to work. And also a credit to Bradley and others, later on, they started doing some very well-controlled studies of the stimulants, like randomized design, crossover, placebo controls, and found that across the board, the different preparations of stimulants that came over the year, they were consistently found to be helpful in terms of improving the behavior, specifically improving impulse control, reducing hyperactivity, and improving attention. And the other thing, and you don't hear much about this, they've generally been among the best researched medications, not just psychiatric medications, any medications prescribed to kids, and have generally found to be pretty safe. So over time, we've had different preparations of stimulants, and in more recent years, a wider array of medications, including many, or at least a fair number of non-stimulant medications, to give a wider range of medication options because, you know, some people can't tolerate the stimulants or need to have them augmented with other medications.
And it's interesting because I believe that the stimulants were originally introduced in 1937.
And
was, Ritalin was introduced, what, 20 years later, like in 1956?
I believe so, yeah, around that time.
And I had done some research, because what my notes is that Adderall didn't come around until 1996. And then
that's been relatively recent, and Strattera as well, in 2003, the first non-stimulant. And that was also notable, if we're talking about, you know, further evolution and future directions, it was the first medication that had FDA approval for use with adults with ADHD.
And what's interesting to me is that my brother once told me, he got his doctorate in physics, there's more scientists alive today than all throughout history. And he said, you think about it, through history you had to put like food on tables. In order to be a scientist, you had to have money, you had to have time to do this stuff. And it's amazing the acceleration that's taken place because it was 37 that it was introduced. Not a lot happened, but now in the last 15 years, it's starting to accelerate, and we're starting to get a lot of alternatives that are actually, in some situations where maybe Ritalin didn't work, some of these other ones are starting to kind of help out, and we're actually kind of honing in and becoming more specific, which is really exciting.
Right. And different lengths of action, so it can be tailored to a person's individual situation, yes.
So at a real high level, I kind of want to review, because I want to just touch base with you before the end of the show about the future of ADHD, but really the first real science or documentation was in 1902. Stimulants were introduced in kind of 37. There was a lot of significant research that was done in the 60s, but really the modern ADHD was built kind of what was kind of going on in the 80s, and we've had an acceleration here in the late 1990s and early 2000, et cetera, of stimulants and moving forward. And then in 2004, the U.S. Senate established National ADHD Awareness Day, which is exciting.
Right.
Dr. Ramsey, what do you see as the future? Like, what do you see, where do you think we'll be in about 5 or 10 years?
Well, you know what, in some ways, there's one piece of evidence that the future is now. Russ Barkley, one of your upcoming guests, he had what I consider a seminal paper just last year in the Journal of ADHD and Related Disorders about the role of emotions in ADHD. You won't see that anywhere in the official diagnostic criteria. Paul Wender talked about it back in the 70s, but the premise being, and there's, you know, substantial evidence, the same capacity for self-control that we use to regulate behavior, regulate attention, we also use to regulate emotions. And so, you know, handling, you know, frustration tolerance or whatnot. So I think that's going to be increasingly appreciated. The next several years, and I may be biased because this is an area of interest of mine, more and more research on adults with ADHD. I think, of course, the imaging technology is getting better and more refined. Maybe more medication options and looking at combination regimens. I think looking at the non-medication treatments, how much can we change beyond medications? And also families, what we know about the genetics, I think family treatments, relationship treatments, looking at families with more than one generation with ADHD, one caregiver and one child, because that's a unique mix. And I think some of the typical marital therapy, family therapy, if it's tweaked a little bit with an appreciation for ADHD, that's a unique family system. So I think ongoing work and research in those areas, because I've not been able to find any outcome studies looking at couples or family therapy with individuals with ADHD, that's another, you know, exciting development.
Absolutely. I want to kind of pause here for a second. For our listeners out there in the chat room and that are online right now or on the phones, we got 19 seconds, and you guys are going to lose connection. We're going to continue over a little bit here. to catch the end of the show, if you go to attentiontalkradio.com and download, just skip for the first 30 minutes, and you can catch the end. So with that being said, you guys are going to lose it in about 2 seconds. Dr. Ramsey, we are still streaming, at least for our podcast listeners here. This is interesting because I wanted to kind of just – what I'm hearing you say is that we have an exciting stuff that's kind of going on. We're re-looking at some of the things that are going on, and I'm sensing science is, because of the technology, we're on the verge of coming up with more specificity in order to define the different types of ADD, the different things that are kind of going on, and start associating different drugs that might work with different things, but more importantly, very effective medication type treatments for those with ADHD to kind of manage what's going on. Is that the hope for the future?
That's certainly my hope, and I think the hope of a lot of clinical researchers out there. And also, even when we go back to, you know, George Still, William James, Alexander Crichton, we even have, and I think in fairness, they had quite a sophisticated appreciation of the multiple aspects of attention. But even looking right now and how we understand ADHD, there's the subtype, if you will. Some people will argue it's maybe even somewhat different than ADHD, sluggish cognitive tempo as a diagnostic category, where it's more daydreaminess, having a hard time getting attentionally engaged in what's going on around, and also individuals who fit the sluggish cognitive tempo profile tend to not respond as well to the stimulant medications. They seem to respond more to medications for anxiety and some of the psychosocial treatments. So again, what, you know, 20, 30 years ago could have just been lumped into ADD at the time, now we're getting this finer view of the different shades of it and how there might be subtle and not so subtle differences in the treatment options that are offered that may have a better chance of helping these folks. Again, what I think ultimately what we really want to measure is how individuals are doing in day-to-day life.
And I have to there was a common thing that you were talking about is the differences in ADHD and how we're able to kind of subdivide them. You didn't say that specifically, but I got to point our listeners that listened to this to a show that we did back, I think it was in October of 2009 with Dan Pruitt, and it was the many different versions of ADHD, and we just kind of went through the math based off of the three different subtypes, ADHD, inattentive, and combined, and just based off of those, we talked about the number of symptoms you had to be diagnosed, and there's like 18,000 different combinations that you could have in order to be diagnosed with ADHD, and the point really here is that we're starting to refine that stuff down and realize some of the stuff is different, and we're able to manage it a little bit differently based off of more and more science that's coming to knowledge, which is really kind of exciting.
Right. And you know what, one of the other interesting things, and again, you'll have him on in a few weeks, Russ Barkley, we're getting better assessment measures. And one of the things some of Dr. Barkley's recent research is showing, that self-report questionnaires regarding symptoms, particularly for adults, and also disorders of executive function in day-to-day life, that the descriptions of impairments in day-to-day life are probably a better predictor of ADHD and the level of difficulty than the available neuropsychological tests we have right now. So even though there's this desire for, understandably, the test for ADHD, I think if a good working with somebody, a good clinical interview, and finding out what's not working, if we find out somebody's having difficulty in school, in work, that, you know, and we can confirm that with corroboration, you know, somebody else seeing it, a report card, that is sufficient evidence of impairment to warrant treatment. So we don't necessarily have to have, we may still look for, is there a good quote-unquote test out there, but right now, finding out how is this person doing in day-to-day life, it's almost like what is the progress we've been making, it's to find out, you can find out a lot just by asking and just by looking.
Absolutely, absolutely. Before we wrap some things up, I want to remind everyone that you're going to be back on in, I think it's May the 4th, and we're going to be talking about an area of your expertise, and that's non-medication-type treatments. So I want to remind everybody, be attuned to that. Again, that's May the 4th, if I'm not mistaken, at 8 o'clock, same bat channel. So everybody look out for that. And again, Dr. Ramsey, I'd like to thank you for coming on the show. And one last time for those out there who might want to contact you, can you give your email address?
Yes. My last name, Ramsay, R-A-M-S-A-Y, at mail, M-A-I-L, dot med, M-E-D, dot UPenn, with two N's, dot E-D-U.
Excellent. Thanks again, Dr. Ramsey. We'll look forward to having you back on in May. Everyone else out there, next week we're going to have Ruth Hughes talking about CHAD membership. We're going to get into detail about the memberships they have and all the resources that are available. So till next week, enjoy.